This podcast is supported by the growing community of artists and art lovers through the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/John Dalton Gently Does It to join the conversation. I'm very happy to be talking to Pamela Wilson today in California. Pamela is an artist. She paints evocative, narrative, figurative paintings. They're technically brilliant and they're packed with atmosphere and questions. She's had numerous solo exhibitions and her work is collected widely. And she was recently named one of the top 100 oil painters working today. So, hello, Pamela. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hello, John. It's lovely to be on your show. Thank you.
You're very welcome. My show. I didn't really ever think of it as a show, but yeah. Okay. Welcome to
It's a show, John.
Welcome to the show. Yeah. Okay.
For me, it's a show.
Okay. Now, you just had your first international show in Australia, in Melbourne. How did that come about?
Well, I belong to a collective that was created by John Bannart, who lives in Australia, in Melbourne. And he was doing these, I think the collective started because probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, I'm not really sure when he started, but he would see a lot of work that was really well done and beautiful and kind of odd sometimes. But the main thing that was, it was really well done, but it didn't fit anywhere else. He was gathering artists that didn't seem to fit anywhere else, and he sort of brought them together, and he would do these shows. He would come up to Los Angeles and do shows at Bergamot Station at Copro Gallery, and he invited me to be in a couple of those. And then the collective sort of grew into something a little bit bigger, to where he was having, you know, there were probably, I don't even know, probably 100 artists. The group was just growing, and it was sort of taking on a life of its own. So he would once or twice a year, I think maybe once a year, come all the way to America, put together this a show at Copro Gallery of all of the artists that he could get from the collective. And so we would all go down and we'd all met each other, and it sort of became this little love group. And then and he would do books and things like that. And it was really nice to meet other people in the group. And you say, oh, you're a part of the collective. And it was just this really warm thing. And I kept thinking, like, I don't really belong there. I don't know why he keeps asking me to be there, but I love it. I'll do it. So I never really felt like I was sort of like the other lowbrow artist. It was a lot of like lowbrow work and things like that that didn't really fit anywhere else, as far as I could tell. But at any rate, so I was in a couple of the shows. And then just very recently, he did a Kickstarter. He did a Kickstarter because the collective was not making enough money for him to continue doing the books and the shows that he wanted to do. So he was trying to just get enough funding to continue with 2 shows a year. The response was overwhelming. All of the artists contributed to help. And together, we all created enough money or gathered enough money that he was able to open an actual brick and mortar gallery down in Melbourne where he lives. So that's been open for about a year now. And he's just, you know, he's giving everyone a show, sometimes 2 or 3 in a group who don't have time to, you know, get ready for a solo or, you know, and there are some solo shows. But so I was invited to show with the married couple, Kit King and Corey Pop, also known as Oda. And so that was really fun. You know, we hadn't known each other. We kind of talked and came up with a title and all did work under the title and showed together without ever really, you know, working or collaborating in any way. So it was kind of fun, but it was great getting to know them a little bit. They do amazing work, by the way. And so that's how that came about. And that was, like you said, my first international experience. So I experienced the cost of shipping to Australia.
You weren't able to go to the opening yourself, though, were you?
No, I wanted to go, but number one, I hadn't got my passport application in yet. I've been trying to do that for years. And I just, my schedule has just been horrendous, so I really didn't have the time to go. I had something else to do right after that. So that's the bigger problem.
Wow, that's such an encouraging story. So this chap, John, what was his surname again?
Bannart.
Bannart. Bannart. Okay, so he's Australian, and he organized all this from Australia. Is that right? Did I understand
Correct.
You right? Wow.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And what's the collective called?
It's called the Bannart Surrealist Collective. And I don't know if that's changed, and I should probably write that down and check that. But I believe that's what it's called.
Okay. Well, that's great. I'll put a link in the show notes. Absolutely. Sounds brilliant.
The gallery's doing great, and they're my heroes because of just watching them. They're a lovely married couple. They have children. They're beautiful people. They're a lovely gallery to deal with. No matter what goes wrong, they've got a positive slant on it, and that is just so completely perfect for artists. It just calms you down. You know, if you have a problem, instead of, you know, facing someone who's going to tear your head off, you have somebody saying, okay, well, let's try this, you know, very positive.
Yeah.
So I'd love to have a plug for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Solutions oriented. That sounds great.
Absolutely. And always kind. Oh. Never, never anything under their collar, no matter what you do.
Oh, that's good.
And I was late with a few things. But yeah, they're lovely. Lovely gallery, lovely people. Oh, so great. I'm sure they'll do very well.
And is the show is still running now as we're speaking, isn't it? It's finishing soon, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it comes down December 4th, yeah.
Okay. And were you pleased with the whole experience, how it's all gone? Have you got feedback yet?
Yeah, I had High Fructose Magazine has been very good to me. I don't know who loves me over there, but while the show was on, they did a mini article online of my work, the gold work, and plugged the gallery a little bit. So that really helped a lot. You know, of course, on Instagram, I got several new followers, which is always very exciting for an artist. We live for followers. Oh, yay, the word's out.
It's what we live for, isn't it? It's sad.
Sad, isn't it? Sad.
Yeah, that's what we're reduced to.
It's what social media has done to us. And, you know, I could go miles on that. But yes, we all have to play the game of gaining more followers and, you know, getting a following. And you know, it's always about exposure. Anything you can do to get exposure is good. It doesn't mean you have to change the way you work or anything. Exposure can't hurt you, as far as I can tell. So.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, right. I have some questions from, speaking of social media, from Facebook and Instagram. Now, they're all around the same thing. So what I'll do is, they're kind of, you know, technical questions from artists. Oh. So I'll read the two questions out because they're kind of on a similar topic. And then you can kind of go through the two of them because they're kind of the same. Okay. So they're about photo reference. And the first one is from Instagram, and it's from the artist Dave LeBeau. I don't know if you know Dave.
I know Dave.
But, yeah, okay. So he asks, I'd love to hear about how you use photo reference, if you indeed do use it. Do you work from photographic prints of your models or from a computer screen? Do you mock things up in Photoshop or have the entire scene and props shot in one photo? And then the second question is from Facebook, and it's from the artist Nada Decat. I hope I'm pronouncing
that right.
I know
Nada, yes.
And she asks, Nada, all right, there you go. I'd like you to expand on your use of photography. I know you've been attacked for it, but people don't realize how difficult it is to use photography as reference effectively. Like if you have tips about using photo reference, what do you do about distortion? What do you change from the photo, or do you photo in a way that makes sense already to paint? Right, so that's the two of them.
Okay.
But before you finish that, have you been attacked for using photo reference?
I wouldn't say I've been attacked. Very recently, though,
okay.
And I wish I'd done things another way, and I'll explain. However, one of my friends, who I've known for a long time on Facebook, never met in real life, but who I know is a fan of my work, wrote to me in private and said, you know, there are some higher-ups, some really well-known artists talking, and your name keeps coming up as someone who paints on top of photographs, upon them, atop them. And so he says, you should probably, you know, put out some process pictures just to quell everything, you know, put everyone straight. And I thought, my first thought was like, I'm not going to listen to idiots and I don't have to answer to anyone. And then I thought, well, you know, I got a little defensive and I thought, well, I need to attack this head on or something. So I said something on Facebook to the effect that, no, I do not work atop photographs. And it just took off, of course, like things do on Facebook, and had a life of its own. The discussion went on. I didn't participate very much other than in the beginning. And so, you know, and then my wisest friends were writing to me saying, like, why are you even answering that? And so, you know, there was that. But I wouldn't call it an attack, but I did want to set people straight. And there is some smuggery regarding working from life or working from photographs. So I can just tell you that what I do is I take models out and I take objects and things, and I live in dreams. I have the synesthesia, which I'll explain later. And so I'm barraged with images constantly. No matter where I go, I'm seeing paintings all the time, in my home, in the car, everywhere I go. I always think, oh, I got to go over there and shoot, you know. And I just have endless friends who want to model. So I'm really lucky that way. I call it my vein of 21-year-olds. Like, I want to do it, Pam. I want to do it, Pam. Which is great. So I never, I rarely pay models unless they're people that aren't my family, you know. But at any rate, so I have all this living, and then I leave a lot up to chance. So I go out and do actual photo shoots. I do all of my own work. It's all done in one. I don't put anything together in Photoshop. I do not distort in Photoshop, although I've just recently begun to explore that because I think it's going to be fun for the new work I'm going to attack that I'll tell you about later. But so I work, and then I come home and I make those photographs. I might slightly adjust some color if I think it needs it, but I don't do anything. I don't rely on photography. And any artist who does rely too heavily on a photo reference is going to run into trouble, because photos are just photos. You have to be able to have, like, I've done years of painting from life. I don't currently do that very much, but I work direct. I'm kind of getting off track here, but I work directly from my photo reference that I create. I work from the actual photograph. I don't work from a screen, and I don't allow my students to do that because I say that's not real light. You're looking at something that's illuminated. You can't match that color. There's no way. So if you're looking to get good at color and you're practicing mixing color, you want to work from something that's two-dimensional in my mind, or from life, but not from an illuminated screen. That's just going to mess you up in my book. So that's what I do. I just work from my photographs that I make. And, you know, if I need to see something more in detail, I'll blow something up or go find a photograph, because I'll shoot the model, but I go zoom way in on every little thing so that I always have the toenail if I need it. You know, I always have every little detail if I decide to use it. But it's up to the artist to then decide how much of your photograph to use. And you can get addicted to photo reference. And that's sort of what I've been dealing with. I have kind of a coach that I work with who's, you know, says, Wilson, why don't you slap some paint around? And we discuss what happens on the surface and, you know, what realism is about and things that like that. But, you know, in the end, it's me making those decisions of what to leave in, what to take out, how much to put in, how to make it look more dreamlike, you know, those sorts of things. So I rely on photo reference as a tool, but not as the end all. Did I miss anything?
Well, I'm curious. You have a painting coach.
Yeah, and I was trying to decide if I should mention his name. I don't know if I should, but we've been friends on Facebook and in real life now for several years. And he, you know, called me once because he liked my work, and we just started chatting, and we have this great art conversation. It's something that I've never had. I've worked in a dark garage, one day a big boy studio, but today I still work in my lovely garage. / studio. I'm very private about it. However, so I would sit in here and he would call me and we would just talk about the art, and he, you know, we'd talk about art in general and have some good, you know, debates and things like that. But he's a genius, and I can only learn from him. I have nothing to teach him at all. I'm certain of it. But he's been really good to me, and eventually he just kind of poked me, and instead of complimenting me, you know, or talking about art in general, he said, "Hey, Wilson, you know, why don't you slap some paint around? Why don't you do more surface work? Where's your brush strokes? What's happening with you? You need to do something, you know." And he's constantly thinking, and he works with several artists, by the way. However, he got me thinking, and we had this probably 2-year long debate about how I work and how I don't want it to be on the surface. I don't want a surface painting because that changes the meaning of a painting. So for me, it does. I have this desire to bring my people, I call them, into this place, because I want to share these lovely places that I go. And my voice will crack here because I cry about it because it's important. That's sort of the crux of the whole thing for me. It's not about a surface. It's not about pretty paint. It's about trying to share these worlds I live in. Sorry.
No, you're grand.
So trying to create a world for someone to step into negates any possibility of me leaving things on the surface, because then I feel like they can't break that barrier and go in. And he keeps saying, "Oh, I think you're wrong. Oh, I think you can." So we've been fighting it out, and I make little small breakthroughs, and I scream for joy, and I go, "Oh my God, breakthrough, breakthrough," because I loosened up about something, you know. So it's not easy to do once you're addicted to creating a scene, to then try to, you know, it suddenly dawned on me last year that what I have in realism is just another tool. I've been painting 30, 35 years to suddenly realize, oh my God, this isn't the end all. Making a picture, making shit look like shit isn't the end all. It's just a tool.
That's such a quotable line, that making shit look like shit. Pamela Wilson.
It's really like everybody thinks that's what it is until they've painted 30 years and then they realize, oh my God, that's not it at all. That's just a tool.
Yeah, yeah.
So in order to help myself sort of learn a new way, and this is all new and exciting for me, very, very exciting for me. I'm extremely emotional about where I'm finally getting to go, which is very, very scary. And we all laugh. We laugh at each other, my artist friends and I, because we talk about being brave and paint. Like, you know, the world's falling apart and we're crying because we're being brave. Or we want to be brave. We want to be brave and paint. But, you know, I never realized how scary it is to make a mark of your own and leave it. That may sound really simple, but it's very difficult for me to trust my marks and to leave them. So that's where I'm going. It's a huge challenge for me, but I'm really, really excited about where I can go.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. Just now, so I'm clear, when you're talking about surface painting, you mean where you can kind of see the hand of the artist. You can see the brush stroke, the kind of sergeant-y kind of big bravura, kind of, you know, big mad brush stroke where you kind of go, oh, that's definitely a painting. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's marks that we used to, in grad school, we called them gratuitous art marks. And we made fun of people with their drips and their bullshit like that, you know?
Oh, right, you're so important
with your drips and your lights all over your painting. And, you know, we were just really callous, you know, we just hated it. We were early 80s, you know, rock, punk rockers, you know, we just didn't want to be part of it. You know, I had no idea what the bigger world was about in any way, but you know, it was just that sort of thing. And we would just make fun of them. So what I mean, yes, is somehow making a mark that isn't just me saying like, well, that was in the photo, you know.
Yeah.
And my skill copying, I can copy anything. You put it in front of me and I will copy a color. I can render really well. That's my talent. But then half rendering or knowing what parts to finish and what to leave with some of your own marks. Yes, your own brush strokes and things that you thought about. You know, I never thought I had pretty brush strokes. So I've always completed the photo, you know, complete the picture the way it looks, even though I may add things in and change things around. The ultimate goal was to create this real looking space. So if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what I mean by art marks. Yeah, yeah. Your own marks.
Yeah, it sounds like you wanted to like remove the glass on the painting so people could sort of step through it, kind of. That's the yes. impression I'm getting.
That's what I thought I wanted. And that is what I wanted for a long time. And I think that I wouldn't say I've mastered it, but I think I know how to do that. And if I wanted to keep going, I could just get better and better and better at that, as anyone could with practice.
Yeah.
But I wanna make a turn. So that's the scary part.
Mm.
And not knowing that I could make a turn. Just finding out that I can and realizing that, you know, like one of the things we talk about to maybe help understand is like what makes a successful painting. And so we've come up with a few things, mostly my friend has come up with those, but you know, I've helped and I agree that, you know, one of the main ingredients is that it must have is confidence. Painting must have confidence. The other thing a painting must have for me is honesty. And one of the third thing that we both feel it must have is that it just has one odd thing. There's just, so you have to be confident and we have to have that one odd thing. But I added for myself, because it comes up for me a lot, it has to be honest. I mean, there are paintings by one of my painting heroes who is Phil Hill, Justin Mortimer, probably my top two favorite painters, and they're studio mates, by the way, strangely enough. But my coach knows both of them personally and well. As a side point, which I love, and I've met Phil Hill. He's very quiet. But at any rate, even those guys sometimes give me pause because I think, well, is that honest? Because it looks really cool, but I'm not sure I'm feeling them all the way. So I'm very, very in tune with that in a painting. You know, it's like it has to be honest for me. If you're just showing off in some way, or you know, if it's a skew like that, it gets in the way. It's like bad acting in a movie. Like you can't get into the story because that guy's so bad at it. You know, and
yeah,
it trips.
Yeah.
And so that's what dishonesty in painting does to me, where it's not quite complete. It's hard for me to have a gestalt kind of experience with it and just be bowled over. And when I'm bowled over by painting, it's very rare for me. But when I do, I'm gone. I'm in ecstasy. It's just that's what art does for me. It's just an inexplicable joy that I can't explain when I'm moved by work fully.
Yeah. Yeah. When was the last time?
I can tell you that. Early on, what started me down the road that I'm on. And that was, you know, in the late 80s, going to LACMA as a student. And I saw for the first time works by Joel Peter Witkin, Diane Arbus, and Anselm Kiefer. And my whole world changed when I saw them. I've never looked back.
Yeah.
Anything I was going to do was completely ruined by those three. For different reasons, you know, Diane Arbus, or I guess she was known as Deanne Arbus, but, you know, I stared straight at those twins for the first time, and I was completely, I just bawled. I just sat there and cried. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I didn't know what it was, but it really moved me. And then when I got to see the big paintings of Kiefer, everyone was bowled over by the big paintings, but I sort of wandered into this back room and found these huge sketchbooks. They were like probably 2.5 feet, you know, big, and you had to put on the white gloves. And I opened them up, and I had been working in photography and lithography at the time. I was not painting. In fact, I went into graduate school as a lithographer. However, at this time, so I found these big books and I opened them up to see what they were. And they were like big sketchbooks of his that no one seemed to know about. I'd never heard of anything about them. And I haven't since. I have to go look for them. But they had photographs he'd made, black and white photographs, and he'd painted on them. He painted ghosts in them and things like that. And I just, my whole life changed. And I spent the next 5 years making my own huge photographs and painting on them. So, and then when I tried to translate that to paint, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't get it to work. And it was just a pool of tears on the floor all the time. I couldn't make the paint look like what I was doing with the photographs. So now it's been 30 years, and now I'm going to start working from collage and see if I can go there and go to this new place. But it's kind of like when you wake up from a dream that's a great dream, and you wake up and you're like, oh, wait, no, I must go back. And then you lay down and you close your eyes, and then you realize that you're the one who has to write the dream. Like, I don't know what the dream is, you know, and I get really frustrated because I can't imagine what the rest of the story is. And that's how painting is for me right now. I can't see what it's going to be. It's going to be all mine, but I don't know what it is, and I have to go make it. So I have to find ways around this big blank oil skid I see that I have no idea how. I don't know what my work's going to look like. I have no idea. So I have to go find it. And it's a huge challenge.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I just talk in circles.
No, that's good. Yeah. Just to go back, what you were saying about collage, it's going to come from collage. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Well, because of my photographic background, I'm very comfortable working and painting on photographs and playing with those. And I'm constantly, I am what I call a tinkerer. My dream would be never to paint or photograph again, but to build things in my garage with little brass screws and false doors and light boxes and back openings. And, you know, I just love Rauschenberg. Is that who I'm thinking of? Yeah, Robert. His sculptural work moves me. It came from that same era. So just that sort of throwing things together of found objects and whatnot. And Joseph Cornell's boxes, of course, are a huge influence on this thinking. You know, I always wanted to make stuff. Yeah. So I love that. And I sort of put the two together, and I've done a lot of that work, and I'd like to do a lot more, but it's not really marketable. So one day, I think when I'm old and retired, I'll sit in my garage all day and tinker.
Yeah.
Make things with wheels and false doors. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen any of the Automania stuff?
No, I've seen nothing. I've been working straight for like 3 years now. I've gone nowhere, nothing.
It's similar to what you're describing, except it's they're like little, almost like little puppets that have exposed mechanism, and you sort of turn a handle and this little story kind of unfolds. And they have all these little cute little wooden cogs, and the whole thing is handmade.
Ooh,
they're lovely. I
have
really
heard about
them.
Those. Yeah, that's it's come up recently, right? I've seen them everywhere. You can put anything in them, and they make and then you wind them yourself, or you. Yeah, I have seen that. I love.
Yeah, you turn a little.
Yeah, I love those.
Yeah.
Oh God, I love those. Back to painting.
Well, actually, you brought up when you were talking about what constitutes a good painting for you. You mentioned confidence. And I was reading that you said your high school teacher, Sally Christensen, was really important to your confidence as an artist. How important do you think the role of confidence is to a beginning artist?
Oh, I think it's everything. I think that your world unfolds exponentially well. I mean, just so much better if you have confidence at an earlier age and you have someone who can dote on you and tell you what you're good at and encourage you. And really, this woman is still one of my best friends. In fact, I'm going to call her later this afternoon. I talked to her. But she was really wonderful to me by giving me that confidence. She actually, you know, went to other teachers in the school, in my high school, and got me commissions to paint their children. She said, oh, she's just so good. You can't go wrong. I remember my first commission was $80. I couldn't believe I had $80 to paint someone's child, you know. So I was doing commissions in high school of other teachers' children because of this woman, who then, of course, made sure I went to, you know, got scholarship offers and you know, helped me put it all together, because I didn't have that kind of help in my family. We're educated, but not overeducated. And, you know, my sister was a valedictorian and she's a veterinarian and she's, you know, she was our overachiever. And I was just, they'd pat me on the head and say, and Pamela's our artist, you know, it's just what I've always been.
Yeah, right.
So my family was supportive, but they didn't really know how to help me navigate. And that's what she did for me. And so I chose to go to BYU on scholarship and I had some other offers, all because of her. So I can't say enough about good teachers and instilling confidence in people and finding the things that they're good at and then helping them go there. Or if they decide to go the complete opposite direction of that, helping them go that way. But instilling confidence, it's hard to find that yourself. I think when you're young, you have to get that from others. I do.
Right. And you may not be able to answer this, but if, you know, someone's listening to this and they haven't got any support, but they recognize the need for confidence, how could they nurture it themselves?
It's a really good question. Because that's not been my experience, it's hard for me to answer that. But I would say I'm sort of in a position for that right now. I mean, I don't have a coach who's telling me, oh, gosh, you're just so good, you can do no wrong, and you're going to be great at this. I have someone saying, like, you need to challenge yourself, and you need to do this sort of thing. But I know that myself. I don't need a coach. I'm glad I have him. He's made my life just so much better. But it's really hard to do that yourself. But I think it's really important that if you like something you've done, probably to keep doing that and explore that more and to challenge yourself a little bit, because you really can't gain confidence unless you jump over a deep chasm. You know, it's like you have to do something scary to gain confidence. I think if you're not having someone help you instill that, I would say challenge yourself in whatever way you see.
And I think particularly at the beginning, it's having the discernment to differentiate between what's good feedback and what's feedback that you shouldn't pay any attention to. how do you think somebody could navigate that?
I would say take advice from those you respect. I remember when I was at BYU, there was a professor whose classes I never took because I thought his art was bad. I just didn't like it. And in those, back in those days, I had good and bad were my terms for art. I like it. I don't like it. But I didn't feel that this man had any talent, you know, and I didn't think Vincent van Gogh had any talent back then either. I'm like, what is this all about? There's clearly nothing here. So I felt that way about that professor. And then another professor that I liked, when I was discussing it, he said, well, why don't you take so-and-so's class? And I said, well, I don't really like his art, so I don't know what he could teach me. And he said, oh, no, you're looking at it all wrong, Miss Wilson. So he told me, you know, you need to just take information from everyone, and then you decide what you can use and what you can't. And I don't know if that's actually helpful in that case, but I always remember that it doesn't matter what their art is. If they're distinguished in some way, I should listen to them and glean what I can from what they have to say. And I don't really know how to translate that to answer your question. I just think, you know, you have to have some bit of intelligence anyway. I mean, you can't just be an amoeba and expect everyone to lift you up. You have to choose some direction. You know, you may choose the wrong direction. You can always go back, but you have to make some choices yourself. And that's how you gain confidence too, is just by, you know, letting yourself make some choices and fail. I mean, mostly we fail, and it's those little breakthroughs that give us such great joy, because, you know, like right now, wanting to change my work, it's really been hard to put the brakes on my schedule because I'm a people pleaser by far. I am type A people pleaser. I don't like to disappoint anyone. So if someone's asked me to be in a show, of course I will, you know, and then I want to go through with my word. So for like the last literally 3 years, I haven't had a chance to do my taxes, to clean my studio, to clean my house, other than, you know, the top, you know, I just feel it's very important to keep my word rather than back out of things when I realize I don't have time. Instead, I work night and day, and I ruin myself. I've completely ruined. And I think having to, you know, I've had to wait 2 years to make time for myself to make mistakes, to completely fail over and over and over again until I find that one little glimmer of magic that will take me to the next level. I realize, and I think that's the mature part of being an artist, is you realize you can't do it overnight. You think you're going to be good next week. You're not. You need so much time to fail. You really do. No one gets the elevator. Yeah. I mean, some do. I don't know who those people are. Jenny Saville. But she's great. But you know, some people just get the lucky breaks, and that's great. And some would say that about me, I'm sure. And you know, it's different for everyone. But I think you have to have time to fail, and you have to expect to fail. And failure is different for everyone, what that means. So you know, some people are more positive than others. So for me, I'm looking forward to failing because I know that I know me, and I believe, I'm confident that I will find a spark, that I'm good at what I do, and that I'm going to apply that good in new ways. And I'm really excited about it and very positive about it. So knowing that I'm going to fail and be on a pool of tears on the floor a lot, I'm prepared for that. And then I'll find my way. Yeah. And I think that's what we have to do. I really don't think there's an easy way to get confidence. You have to earn it.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Now let's go back to the original question about the photo reference. Let's see if you covered everything. But yes, you answered that bit. You don't use a monitor. And you don't do any compositing on Photoshop.
No.
You get it all in the one, in the photo shoot.
Yep. Okay. I try to use it minimally. Yeah. For me, it's just a tool, the Photograph. And so I'm trying to do the minimal things. I don't want to do a bunch of fancy things on Photoshop and then paint that. Although I think it can be another tool. So.
Right. Yeah. And I think the reference to distortion, I think that's the distortion that can just happen in the optics of a photograph.
Sure.
That's not an issue for you?
No, I think because I think I compensate for that a little bit. And I'm also, you know, like when I zoom in on a foot, it's going to be at a slightly different angle. And that's where, you know, years of drawing the figure come in. You know, I can sit and draw a figure from life. I know how to foreshorten. I've learned to do all that sort of thing. So when I'm painting, I use all that knowledge. I'm sure of it. So if a foot is turned wrong, I know what a foot looks like. And if I need a foot, I can find one, you know. But I don't rely so heavily on that angle or that distortion. And actually, the last painting I did, I really distorted it for fun. I'm just starting to explore that. So there's one I'm working on where like one knee is really huge and one's skinny and small over here. And I think like, oh my God, do they think I can't draw? And then I realize I have to take that a little further since no one knows that new part. So it's all new things I'm going to explore. I'm not completely opposed to it. But in the past, I would say up until now, I compensate for that just fine. I don't have any issues because I'm not over connected to the photo. I'm more interested in the painting. And the more time I spend staring at the painting as opposed to the photo, the more I know I'm just off in my own direction. And sometimes things don't work. You know, I draw it on. I mess up. And I like some of those mess ups. You know, I've seen people like, I won't say whom, but there are a lot of artists out there who are projecting onto a white canvas and taking a very fine pencil and probably spending upwards of hours and hours drawing on. I mean, I've not seen it, but I can imagine because I can see the little marks and they're the tiny little marks around every little thing. And then there's that little bubbles mark. And so literally they just go from one side of the painting to the other, filling in the paint by number to me. That's how I see it. It might be harsh, but I don't feel like you can make the fun mistakes you need to make and that you're just at that point, you're just an artisan. You're just transferring something. And it may be an old fashioned kind of way. But where's the art for me? Like, where's the mistakes? Where's the magic? Where's the arm that's too long, you know, that you have to fix and then have to come up there? And then the painting sort of just bends in a cool way. And, you know, I get accused a lot of painting on photographs because I think I'm probably done a lot of it and I'm probably pretty good at making it look like it, you know. But, you know, I sometimes will look at my photo reference and I've gone way off, you know, on my painting. It's just like, I don't care. I like it. So, but there's a, you know, any of that I think is fine. But my honest belief is like by any means, that's what I say to people. Like, I don't care how you get there. I don't care if you draw it on, just move me. You know, I really, you know, and I know that there are some really huge artists that I think I know paint directly on photographs. And then they do a couple washes on it and call it a painting, you know, and then I used to have a real problem with that. And now I think like, who cares? The end result is really cool looking. So that's sort of been my attitude for a few years now, is like, sort of by any means, however you get there, I really don't care if you move me.
Yeah.
So it's made my life a lot easier to just feel that way and drop my shoulders and say, so you want to do it that way? Fine. In the end, it's kind of cool looking, you know? So, I mean, if you look at like a Jenny painting where she's completely all over the place, you know, and leaves all of her wonderful marks, and it's really cool and it's very moving and punches you in the gut and you feel the hatred and the love all at the same time. I just love her. But then I'll look at like Eli Morales, whose work I vaguely know. You know, I know that he wins a lot of awards and things, but he's one who works the way I just described, at least in large I've seen. But in the end, if I didn't know how each artist worked, they're very different products, but both are very moving in their own way. So I can accept that. I can. I think I can accept anything except liars. I don't like liars. Anyway, I'm over that too. Maybe that's part of the art. I don't know. Just own it. Whatever you do, own it. You know? It's fine.
Okay. Now, if I understand the inspiration side of your process, part of it involves antique shopping for elements that will go to make up the visual story of your paintings. I was kind of curious what you do with the antiques when you're finished with them, because as you say, you've been painting for 35 years. Like, is your house like, do you have a really big house? Is it all like stuffed with years of antiques, or do you pass them along? Do you reuse them?
Well, that's been an issue of late. I have a roommate that I live with. He's my son's father, and we've been friends for 35 years, blah, blah, blah. So we're just, we're family. But so we fight like an old married couple. And one of the things he always says is, you got to get all that crap out of the attic. I got to work up there. So it is an issue, and I do have some very expensive antiques, and I'm not respectful. I'm very irreverent with antiques, and I will paint them, I will ruin them, I will rip them, I will re-sew them, whatever I need. So up until now, I will tell you that that is how I've worked, and I do collect all of my antiques, and I just really recently contacted someone and said, look, I'm going to give you all these, you sell them, we just split it half and half, whatever you want to do with them. She said, great. So that's one, because I don't have time to go sell things on eBay, and I'm just not interested. So I would either sell everything as a lot right now or something. But it's all going to change, John, because my work, I really am serious about taking a new direction. And my coach just told me that I'm known as the steampunk artist. And I had no idea, other than I invented steampunk, by the way, back in the 90s. I mean, I was painting goggles on people long before anyone called it steampunk. But I just realized, oh my God, he's right. I was thinking that I'm throwing in all these objects from different eras and I'm creating this very off the cuff new world and everything. And then he said, no, you know, all your steampunk stuff. And I was like, oh my God. So it hit me like a brick and I realized, oh, I am so stuck in a rut. So it's all going. I'm done with that. I'm going to work in some different ways and I'll probably save some key pieces. And like, I love neon. I collect neon lights. I have actually two now and I just broke one. So that's my big collection. But they're expensive and hard to find, and you have to go get them or mail them. So anyway, but I really want to use light differently now. I painted neon all last year and just fell in love with it. And I've been working with gold, as you may know. And so I'm trying to find all these crazy ways to pop me out of what I know, the known, and into the unknown. Yeah, right. I need the shock of the new in my studio. So I'm definitely going to change how I work. And the collecting antiques and the way I've put things together is really going to change now. I'm so excited to just, you know, Hey, I'm 54. I got to do some living now. And for me, that's living. I mean, you know, I love to go on road trips and collect things, and I will still do that. I haven't done that for a couple of years now, obviously so busy, but that will be my love. But you know, I'm going to a new planet. I'm going to go create a new planet. So all that's going to change. Right. But yeah, it is hard with the antiques.
It might be worth getting in touch with Bo Bartlett and his center, because one of the things he's interested in is, as well as the paintings, is collecting sketchbooks and the other stuff that goes into making up an artist's body of work, you know? So it sounds like your stuff is very interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, so definitely be worth an email. So,
Yeah. I don't know Bart, but I've of course known his work for years.
He's lovely. Yeah. He's a lovely fella, and you know, you can email his you know, you can't get straight through to him, but you know if you just say what you're getting rid of your stuff, they might be interested in it, because it kind of, I could see a display there, you know. The way he described it to
anyway. All my stuff hanging around is all in paintings.
Yeah.
And then The problem is, like, I fall in love with certain objects because I just think they have ghosts and they're wonderful. But then I use them too much. It's like, oh, that was in that painting too. And then suddenly somebody will want three paintings from three different, you know, years, and they all have one object. And so I'm like, oh dear, you can't do that. So I need to recycle more and get rid of them. But I'll definitely look into that. Thank you for that. That might be interesting. Someone might be interested in that. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, this is another question from Facebook. It's from the artist Sean Chambers in Maine. And he asks, I'm very interested in how you handle the underpainting.
Okay. Well, I'm very traditional that way. I used to rabbit skin glue and just do the whole thing. It's so, like, I work with the conservator now here in town, and he's wonderful. But he says, you know, artists, you know, that they think they can do this rabbit skin glue. They can't. If they're off by the slightest degree, that thing's a crack in 10 years, you know. And so he says, artists should never use rabbit skin glue. So he forbid me to do anything like that. He said, you just need to use golden gesso. You'll be just fine. So I do. I use golden gesso, and I sand between coats, and, you know, I get it to a certain amount of smoothness or a certain level of you know, smoothness that I like. And then I'll tone it with a fast drying color, like an ochre or something. I tone the canvas very lightly. And then I just start drawing on with paint. So I use that same color. And the first coat is all just a turpentine wash drawing from, you know, and I'll be holding a reference in my hand, which is why I don't paint with a palette in my arm, because I'm holding a reference with my left hand and I'm standing and painting with the right hand. So then I draw it on like that. I used to, you know, I've done grisaille and things like that, but I'm just really fast at what I do. I've done it long enough. So I do like a wash drawing of it, just really light. And then I just start with the color. I just go right in. I don't do an underpainting. I don't need to. It doesn't help me. I'm really good at value. I just sort of work it out as I go. I used to teach in graduate school, and I mentor students down at Laguna College of Art and Design, just mentor graduate students who don't really necessarily need help with painting. But a couple of times I've noticed that the skill hasn't caught up to what they're trying to do. So they're trying to, you know, deal with value in a painting and color at the same time, which is what we're all doing. But it's very difficult because it's exponentially difficult to go from value and then add color as well. So if you're not really good at value, you should not be adding color. So I taught a figure painting class where the first week I realized no one knew what they were doing with color. So I told everyone to shut it down, and we turned it into like a drawing class for 2 weeks. And we went out and we drew and we studied value before they added color because they didn't know what they were doing. And it's just, you can't learn sideways. You know, so
it's all canvas, or do you do boards as well?
Both.
I think you
do both,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what determines that? The picture, or do you kind of go, yeah, this would be better on a board? Or
it's more just mood. You know, sometimes I get bored with canvas and I just want something really smooth and just slick like marble. So I'll build it up and do that for a while. And if it's not, now I'm getting really particular for some reason. Like I don't like to work on certain types of wood, and, you know, I don't like the feel of a panel like that. So, but now that I'm working with gold, I want everything supported. I used to work in gold leaf back in like 2003, 2004, and I did a bunch right on canvas. And I've just seen some of those works recently by the collectors, and they're still in great shape. So I'm not really worried about it, but I think just – I don't glue the canvas down, but I stretch canvas over like a birch panel, a nice birch panel, and then I'll just gesso as normal. So it just has that support underneath. I like that extra added stuff. And it's fun to paint. Right.
Do you do color studies or value studies, like smaller versions, or do you use, is the photograph like your color study as such?
If I'm being honest, which I'm going to be, usually I do the study, quote unquote, after the painting, because I want a smaller version of it, or I need one to go somewhere. But I don't need, once again, I just don't feel like I need to do studies. I do the studies as I paint. I like to allow for those mistakes to happen. I don't want everything secure and known. I'm just not that kind of artist. I'm looking for a little magic here or there. And I think for the last few years, I've not been able to pull that off, which is why I'm unhappy as an artist. And I want to move on to new areas. I didn't realize I was unhappy, but I'm bored. I'm just really bored. So the last thing I want is to know everything that's going to happen in the painting before I do it, because then I'm just executing and I'm just an artisan once again, a box maker. Yeah. I don't want that.
Yeah. Is it ever a case where you'll get a model to come back in that you've had on the photo shoot to do something from life with that person, or is it always just the photos now?
I have done that. It's very rare. But most of my models are around, and I've had them come over and put that hat on and get in the same light because I just need to see that nose or something. But I don't do portraits of my models. So I may change their eyes. They know that, you know, I may make the eyes look in different directions. That's one of my favorite things. I just love it. To me, it's sort of an indication that the mind isn't fully in sync, which is one of my favorite subjects. Self-portraits, all of them. No, but so, you know, I'm not worried about necessarily having it look just like that model. So sometimes I'll have my roommate give me a hand in the sun, you know, like, oh, that's what the wrist does right there. You know, I'll forget that because I don't have a skeleton in the studio. I should. I need one. Every artist should have one because, you know, I don't know every bone everywhere and I rely on drawing what I see. So if my vision is obstructed, of course, I'm going to have to go look at something. And then it's always like, oh, yeah, of course, I forgot that for me. You know, I don't have it memorized, not that. So, yeah, that happens, but very rarely. I'd rather just go with the mess.
Okay. And how do you check yourself as you're working? Like, are you the sort of jumping back and forth all the time? Are you turning the canvas upside down or do you use mirrors? Or
I do all of that. I have a mirror hung up, so I'm constantly, almost hourly, looking in the mirror. I don't want to look too much because I really want it to be fresh because that's how you find your mistakes. When you turn it upside down, you're tricking your brain. So you're no longer painting what you think you see. You are now painting what you actually see, which is another perfect way to get better. So, and there's a whole book on it. I don't know if anyone knows, but if you haven't heard of the book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, it's an excellent tool. I read it in high school, used it ever since. So what you're doing, you're always trying to train your brain to see. That's what an artist does. You're taking something either 3D or 2D, and then you're transferring it. 2D is much easier. So we're taking a photograph of someone and then I'm already making it 2D and copying it from that. So when you work from life, you're having to condense those things yourself, find those colors. It's really fun to paint from life. I love to do it, but I don't always have the luxury of having a model sit here. And I usually have, you know, a time constraint and I paint really fast. And I, you know, I just would rather work alone from a photograph. And I don't feel any need to get the essence of a model from painting from life. I know how to do that. I know what they're talking about. I just don't feel like everyone has to do that. And I certainly don't. It's not my goal.
All right. Do you have a favorite tool, paint, medium, piece of equipment? Something that you just like, oh, without this now, I wouldn't be able to do my thing.
Well, I've had the same one palette knife for about 15 years. I just look at it. I can't believe it's not broken or lost yet. But other than that, no, not really. No. You know, I need my computer. There are things I need, but not really a favorite tool.
All right.
I mean, I can work anywhere. I can work with anything. I enjoy that. Yeah.
And you, as you say, you worked with the Gold Leaf at the, you know, 2003-04, mm-hmm. and then you've done quite a bit of it recently. Yeah. Are you finished with it now? Have you got it out of your system, or you keep going with it? And
no.
How did you find working with it, coming back to it?
Well, obviously, I think it should be obvious to everyone that Brad Kunkel probably inspired me because his work is so amazing. However, I have to fall short. Someone accused me, someone said, like, wow, that looks a lot like Brad's work. I said, well, it's not if you look at it. But, you know, I was doing it. And then I say, like, well, when Brad Kunkel was, you know, doing his homework in junior high, I was gold leafing. So, yeah. No, I'm kidding. But I would say that definitely seeing his work inspired me. But what I was looking for, and I'll tell you what I'm doing with the gold, is that when I was telling you I'm trying to divorce myself from my fixation with my photo reference, or my addiction, I call it. One of the ways I decided to do that was to try to, because I couldn't quite make the leap, you know, I tried to do some things, but then I would have a deadline and I'd get scared. And so I would pull everything back to realism. You know, I would go wild with the pink and have a blast. And then I think, like, oh my God, I need more time to make this mistake. So then I would pull it back. I've done that a few times, just wheel spinning, I call it, for myself. So what I've tried to do with the gold is, number one, get way good at gold leafing. Because I'm planning to use it in new and unusual ways. So I've been biding my time with it and actually having fun by making myself put things in a space that I don't recognize. And the gold is really lovely, and silver too. I've done some silver and copper as well. But the gold I love because it plays with the light so much. Like, you cannot photograph what these gold paintings do in real life. They're amazing. Every inch you move, the thing completely changes and takes on the world around it. And so it's a living thing for me now. So now I'm working in these areas where I don't have everything worked out. There is no background for the most part. So I have to decide how to integrate it, how I'm going to use the gold in this one. I've done things from putting it way underneath and having it just glow in certain places. and completely disappear at other angles. And then I'm also playing with the gold paint. I'm using Daniel Smith's iridescent gold paint. So all through the paintings, at certain angles, the entire painting just shimmers of gold. So I wanted to make them, number one, monotone. I was completely bored with color. I'm so done with color right now. God, I know every combination. I just don't want to. I don't want to see another. Every time I look at my work in color, I just think, like, oh my God, quit painting clowns. So it's been just an exercise for me to get really good at the gold leaf and find ways and things that it can do I didn't know, and to then, you know, jolt myself out of what I know, out of my knowing. So that's what I've been trying to do with the gold. And so I do plan to continue, but probably not so much in this way. I'm just sort of having fun with these right now. It's a stepping stone for me. And my work will look nothing like Brad's in 5 minutes. So, but I'm happy if they see that. I think he's a master of the gold. He's a beautiful painter. Absolutely inspiring.
Yeah. I know they're very different. When he was on the podcast, he was saying the thing I really liked about what he said about the gold was that for him, it was a way of including the viewer in the painting, because you can't stand in front of a gold painting and not see yourself as you move in the background or wherever the
gold. Oh, wow. I did not listen to his.
Yeah. That was very. You know, it's not something. It's probably really obvious to him and probably to you because you're working with the gold paint. But it's a lovely idea.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt there, but yeah, I was listening to some. Obviously, I've been listening to podcasts, but I had not. I wanted to go to Brad's, but I hadn't got there yet, and so that's interesting. I love hearing that was a similar thing. Yeah, that's what happens. I mean, it's just amazing stuff. And I use the 24 karat because I never like to make my life easy. And 24 karat, like if you breathe wrong, it just disappears or turns black. So finding, you know, experimenting with myself, finding the chemicals that can work on top of each other. Like I use an oil-based adhesive, but I'm still using what I think is a plastic sort of based sealant so that I put it on top of that. But it does sort of mess with the gold underneath. So like I said, I'm learning processes for myself. And I think really there is no one way to gold leaf. And people, you know, there are some basic principles that you must adhere to. But I think people ask me a lot, you know, like, how do you do it? And, you know, I've tried it and it's really hard. And that's the thing, is that you just have to experiment and find, you know, within an archival range, you have to find out what works for you and what the gold can do for you. And different gold lays down differently from different companies, you know, and some come on sheets, transfer sheets, and some don't. And so there's just a lot of experimentation that has to take place for someone to really, you know, learn the nuances of the gold or the silver. And I'm about to tackle more of the silver because I really loved it. I was doing it with color and I wasn't liking the combination. And so since I gave up color, I'm now saying, I think I'm going to do some drawings actually, just pencil graphite drawings with the silver leaf. I'm really excited to go there with some new fun imagery. Mm. So, it's so exciting. I love art.
Yeah. Brad was saying that he, when he was thinking about it, he went and, who did he study with? I think it was like book, illustration people, or you know, the guys who do gold leaf on books and stuff, or bookbinders, that's right. I think it was bookbinders, maybe I'm making that up, but he went and studied with somebody who, you know, sort of tangential to the whole thing, to get all that technical stuff that you were talking about, and about oxidization and the different things that seal it in and whatever. He did all that before he even started, you know.
Well, I wish I'd thought of that, because I'm just doing it myself here, and you know, reading a lot, but trying what I read, and that would have been a smarter way to go. Maybe not, though.
Oh, well, no.
That's my journey.
from what I've seen of your work, you're because there's a lot of people using gold at the moment, and you can tell who's got the, you know, who's really got skillful with it, because when they don't, you see the squares.
Those are acceptable, and those are known. It's like a brush mark. Those are and I've studied a lot of people that use gold currently. And one of the main things is that it's more about like what color they're putting underneath. You know, like there's the red people under the gold and things like that, because the squares are accepted and you can use them as a tool. And everyone accepts the square because that's the form it comes in. So it's almost like a brush stroke. So I just want you to know, you may see that and not like it. And I don't like it. I try to get rid of that. And like, you know, I started adding, you know, birds and butterflies and things where I thought there were discrepancies in the gold. And that's sort of one way to do it. But now I'm starting to think.
Yeah, but you've got big expanses of gold, and there's no joins or seams or anything. It's right. Just flat.
But you do accept those, and like sometimes when I'm and I use the lightest brushes, of course, to brush it on. But at one point, I had this one little line from a brush that had just dragged through, and it's so delicate. And I was really, I thought I was going to have to, and to redo it, I'd have to redo the whole thing, because you can't just redo a part of the gold. You have to do the whole thing at once so that everything lays together nicely. So I kept fretting about this because I really liked where the rest of the gold was, but it had this one line. So I'd asked my roommate, who's also an MFA, by the way, and he said, ah, that's part of it. You know, he said, just remember, you're an artist. You're not a box maker. This is not going to be perfect. That's just part of the work. So I've learned to accept those little things, and I left it. And no one said boo about it, and it was collected immediately. And I'm like, okay. Apparently it's okay to make little marks. So I'm trying to let those mistakes come in. And as I get, you know, as I move into this new area I'm discussing, I think that those may, you know, I'll probably be loose with those and let, I need to loosen up. I'm such a perfectionist and I can't achieve it. So I'm a frustrated perfectionist. So, you know, those little things would normally bother me. I'm going to try to let them go and use them. So, and, you know, I do have to remember that it's art and laying down gold leaf, you know, is hard. And it's a skill acquired, and perfection should not be my goal. My goal is to move people. So maybe you can have mistakes, and maybe they'll add to that ultimate goal. But I think it's important to remember your ultimate goal as an artist. So,
right. Alicia Armstrong was on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she was talking about how different colors kind of had a taste to her, and that led us to talking about synesthesia. And as you said, you actually have synesthesia. So can you, like, for somebody who doesn't know what that is, can you just describe how it manifests for you?
Yeah, I just learned about it two or three years ago, and it's been a huge eye-opener, because as a child, I would ask my sister all the time, like, is your big toe a boy or a girl? And who's the boss of all your toes? And, like, you know, I was constantly barraging her with questions, and she would look at me and say, like, you're mental. Get away from me. You're mental. So early on, I had these odd things. Like, for me, every number has a gender, a color, a personality, every number on Earth, infinitely. Everyone is different, just like a human being. So when I see, like, for instance, the number 23, I see a little boy, two little boys, one's red, one's green. They both have personalities, and together they create a number. So all that happens in a flash for me. I live in pictures. My whole life is pictures. I'm barraged with constant imagery that I want to paint. Everywhere I look, I see, oh, you know, it comes to me. And I gathered, you know, that I wasn't like the others a long time ago, but I didn't know what it was. I just thought it was mental. So then I read about synesthesia probably 5 years ago, maybe six. And then I read my favorite author has it, who's Nabokov. And so it just started opening up. And then I met Chet Czar can taste your name. He tastes your name. Yeah. And suddenly you're a meatball, you know, something like that. So for me, it manifests in strange ways. But what is your brain takes – I don't even know how to put it right. I'm not a scientist, but it's something like this. So when you take in information, your brain – sends the wrong signal, so you feel it in the wrong sense. So you'll taste music, or you'll hear colors, things like that. That's generally how it manifests. And for me, it's just been crazy. Like when I'm looking at Facebook on my computer and I want to go to someone's wall, I actually go there, and it's a huge file cabinet in front of me. So I know exactly where my mother lives, I know where my sister is, and I have 5,000 friends, and all of them are somewhere. So when I go to their wall, I actually go there. It's exhausting. And the same with if I'm talking about, like, the year 1921, you know, I actually go there when I think about it. And I don't really know another way to explain it, except that for me, it makes me crazy, but it's amazing. I dream very, very just amazing dreams. In fact, all this new work started because I had a dream about albinos. And I have no idea why. I have no connection to albinos, but I'm going with it. I really believe in using dreams, especially ones that I have. They're so vivid, and I learned about lucid dreaming actually a long time ago when I was having recurring nightmares as a teenager. I read that I could wake myself up in my dream and stop it. So I was literally raped every night in my dreams for probably 10 years. Until I read about lucid dreaming. Wow. And then I woke up in my dream the first time I tried it. I said, no, you don't have to go there. And I got out of it, and I never had the dream again.
Wow, brilliant. Well done.
So I really listened to those dreams and what I do. So I probably haven't helped explain it at all. It's very confusing for me as well. I just know I have it because I recognized when I read it that's me. That's me.
Yeah. It sounds like it's predominantly visual for you. It doesn't sound like you get much crossover, like you don't taste colors or you don't smell numbers. It sounds like it's just mainly visual for you, is it?
Yes, it's just visual. And it's more of everything sort of taking on a life in front of me. like the numbers, you know, it's like, yeah, and my toes, yeah. And, you know, I literally look at my fingers and they're, some are boys and some are girls and they all have a personality. It's just, it's crazy,
yeah.
But it works for me. And it's probably the reason I'm an artist, not realizing, you know, it's not because I draw well, it's because I have this world I got to get out of me. And like, you know, I started dating someone recently and I was talking and he said, wow, your work's really dark. I wonder if it'll change when you're happy. And I said, no, I am happy because I get it all. I leave it all in the studio. You know, I paint the dark side. I'm fascinated with my dark side. But when I go out, I'm a happy person. I'm fun. You know, I don't sit around lamenting life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that tarot cards show up in quite a few of your paintings. What's your interest in them?
I started exploring the tarot cards. I'm very scientific. Let's just put it that way. I'm not religious. I've always said this, you know, that I don't, well, I grew up Mormon. And once I left that, I was not religious anymore. I was agnostic for a while and I'm probably still agnostic, but that's beside the point. The point is that I wanted to sort of, you know, I had so many people ask me my sign constantly. What's your sign? Oh, yeah. So I just started lying to people. They'd say like, oh, what sign are you? And I'd say Capricorn. Oh, they'd say, I see that. Oh, of course. You know, and of course, I'm making this crap up. And I had a really good teacher in college when I was at San Diego State. And I took, it was like psychology 101 class, just a survey class. And in this class, she said at the beginning, and this might be a slightly long story, but so she said at the beginning, I'm going to follow two of you students very closely. I'm not going to tell you which ones, but I'm going to be observing you throughout the semester. And at the end, I'm going to make an assessment of your personality and you'll tell me what you think. So we sort of forgot about that. And so the end of the semester comes and she says, remember, and brought it up again. And then she handed out two little envelopes. And one was to me and one was to another student, a male in the class. And she said, please read this to yourself, and then I'm going to ask you to comment on it and tell me how good I did. So I read mine, and I could not believe, as I'm reading it, how accurate she was. How did she know me so well? She was so specific. She commented on my exact personality, and I thought, wow, she's amazing. She's got me. And so she asked me, she asked the other guy first, and he said, wow, I can't even believe you're this good. And he basically said what I was thinking. And then she said, will you please read it aloud? What he read was exactly what I got. And so I realized what she had done was say all the things that you think about yourself, like, oh, you're so intelligent and all these things. And they seem really specific, but we all think those things about ourselves. So what I learned is the power of the mind to be, you know, the malleability of it, if that's a word even, the mind is malleable and you can really sort of make it think whatever you want. And that was an early lesson for me. And so from then on, anyone who wants to know my sign just gets a big fat lie from me. And I laugh at them. It's like, seriously, do you really think where the sun was has anything to do with what I'm doing right now? And they're like, yes. So when I got into the tarot cards, it was to make fun of them. Plus, I thought they would be really, I love to work under theme. So back, I was showing with Claire Oliver in New York, and I did a show in 2012 called Between the Hermit and the Moon, where I painted the 22 tarot cards, basically. And I didn't quite get to finish the show, and there's a whole story behind that. But many of the paintings are from that that sort of thing. So, and I'd actually just purchased a new set of tarot cards because they are all skulls and skeletons, and I thought they'd make great tattoos, which I love to paint on people. So, I don't know. I'm not so much into them anymore, but I really like the poetry of all that. The unanswered questions is really fun, especially when you apply them sort of to a theme and can take them in a direction.
Right. Okay. So it's purely from the kind of visual side of it you went at it. It's not like you used them or anything.
Not just visual, but the making fun of it. Yeah. There was something more to it. I wanted to stick it in people's faces a little bit. And I ended up mostly just having fun, you know, because there's so many possibilities. Yeah, and it's what I thrive on. It's like, oh, I'm going to make the Empress. It's going to be so cool. You know, and it took a model down to Balboa Park and all the rooted trees and, you know, made her an underground Empress. You know, it was really fun. So mostly that was the fun.
Well, as you were saying about your work there being kind of therapeutic, I know you had a very difficult kind of childhood. How much of your past do you think you've processed through your art at this stage?
I don't think I'll ever be finished with that. And, you know, I was just talking to someone about that. You know, we probably live in our childhoods much more than we think we do. And I think never having my father's, I never felt like my father knew I was a good person. You know, he was always putting me down kind of thing. So I think that I don't think I ever fully recover from that. And I will probably be in that mode for the rest of my life, I gather.
Right. Because I've been looking at all your paintings, you know, chronologically, you can kind of see things coming in and out of them. And just when you were saying, you know, about your work being therapeutic for you, you could kind of see you processing stuff in your work.
Right. I think that I don't think I want to be finished processing. I think that, you know, you're never finished, you know, you're never done. What I say, I'm done processing that. Now what am I going to do? You know, I think that it will always feed my work. I think it's the reason that I do work. I think I want to constantly use that. I don't think I want to process it as in get through it and move on to something else. I think it informs all of my work and always should inform all of my work. I was terrorized by my brother and I lived in that fear for a lot of years. So that will always be with me. And I welcome it. I mean, that's what makes me human, is choosing to overcome that, but accept it as a part of who I am. I overreact to some things. I cry easily. You know, these are probably reasons that go way back to that. And I don't think I need to change that. I just, you know, I can behave better. I can try not to cry more, you know, something, but you know, I'm an honest person. And when things hit me, in an emotional place, I have a natural reaction. It's, I can't help that. And no, you know, processing to me means that you're putting it through a machine and putting it in its place and then moving on to the next thing. And I'm not sure that I want to do that or that I can do that. I want that bend on everything that I do. I think that informs it. Like I said, I'm just sort of repeating that now.
Well, just from the outside, right? When I looked at the children, particularly in the very early work, and the children in the most recent work, they're very different, and they seem like there's a much they're lighter, even though they're pretty dark. Uh-huh. They're still lighter in the current work. I don't know if
interesting.
That's what it looks like to you, but certainly to me as I looked at it.
Oh, I'm going to have to look into that. I hadn't really thought of that. So that'll be something, because they're not in front of me right now. It's hard for me to actually, strangely enough, pull them up and think which you're talking about. I just think that I'm older, you know, I'm 54 now and I'm not 30 anymore. You know, it's like I've lived a lot and life looks different at 54 the rest of your life than it did at 30. You know, it's a huge difference. And I'm much more mature now. So maybe the focus is somewhere else. And maybe the focus is now on the actual children that I know rather than on me. I don't know. I'd have to look into that to see what that change is. I'm sure there's something there that you're touching on. I'm just not aware of it right now. Yeah. Children to me are very special as models. And I let them come out. I choose very special children who I have a connection with. They're always someone that I know deeply and love very much, from my own to, you know, like I was dating someone for a long time recently who had two young girls and, you know, they're like family to me. So when we broke up, I didn't just have to break up with him. I had to break up with all of them and it's devastating. So, you know, I paint them a little bit probably to process, to get through it. So there's a sadness there, but they're also brilliant little thinkers. And so I wanted to get that too. So that may be more my focus now than on like, oh, woe is me. I ran from a brother with a knife all my life. You know, it's like, it wasn't really about that. That might be it.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got a few quick questions. Do you actually like steampunk?
I like antiques. I don't think I like something once it becomes a movement or a thing, because they make a lot of little fake stuff. You know, no, I don't. I don't like steampunk. I'm sick of steampunk.
Okay.
I like objects. I like the objects I have because I got them because they spoke to me. I'll walk in an antique store and say, I know you're in here, find me. And then I find that object and I'm excited and I go home and I think up a whole story around it and I execute, you know, so it's like that for me. So it's not about steampunk. Yeah. It's about that connection. Yeah.
Yeah. The movie, The Piano. Do you like that movie?
I do like that movie. I've seen that movie a couple of times. Right. I like that movie a lot. From what I remember, I may not recall all of it, but
no, it's just when I was looking at your work today and yesterday, that movie kept coming into my mind. I was just curious. I was going to ask you if you liked it.
We're talking about the war-torn that piano, right? Wait, I'm confusing it. There's
no, that's The Pianist. The Piano is the one set in New Zealand with Holly Hunter.
Yeah, that's
and
the one I thought.
Paquin when she was a young.
Right,
yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay, good. Yeah, I love it.
What is your daily pleasure reading?
Oh, my goodness. I'm in the middle. I was just telling someone last night, I'm like 150 pages into like 5 books right now. My all-time favorite author is Nabokov, and I'm a ferocious reader. I love to read. It informs everything I do. It's part of my process. I think the brain is dead unless you feed it. You get nothing out unless you put things in. So that said, I read Nabokov. I've read everything he's ever written, probably, you know, and I have my favorite book ever is probably Lolita because of all the levels there. But that's not what you asked me. I'll finish that thought, though. Because this is someone who's a pedophile, the character in the story, and because it's one of the first books he wrote in English, and because of the way he can make you fall in love with a criminal and watch that criminal begin to loathe himself, all these layers I find incredibly moving and interesting. And that's what I look for in a book, is that it's got to move me. I have to just be dying to find out what's next. I'm trying to get through, to leap forward. I'm really trying to get through Infinite Jest. It's way over my head. And I have to read it, you know, every page probably 3-4 times. But I love it. And I love him. And it just takes me for a ride every time I read it. And that's what I look for in my personal reading. I need to go to these other worlds. I'm also reading at the same time a very moving but strange book for me, not one I would normally pick up, but I did for some reason, and I was just riveted from page one. It just had me, and that's Ghost Soldiers, about World War II and this group of American soldiers who are trapped in Japan at the end of the war and trying to escape with their lives. And oh, this story is just amazing. And it scares me. I get scared at night. You know, I don't want to be alone because it's that good. So, you know, I like to juxtapose different kinds of reading material together. And I've always been someone who picked up one book and just read it straight through and couldn't stop. So for me to have several going, I feel like I think that with this last relationship, I had less time to read. And so I kind of lost my thing, you know, my way of doing it. And now I'm having to kind of get back into it and figure out why I like to read and what do I want to read and why. And now that I keep saying I'm 54 because my whole life changed when I turned 50. All of a sudden I feel like I was out of time. I don't have time to mess around anymore. So everything has to count now. Like, I'm not going to talk to that person today because I don't have time, you know, or something. I just feel like suddenly my world got smaller and I had to pick and choose what I can do and what I'm going to read. So it's like, it's not so open-ended. And I know that's sort of not the way I want to be. I'm going to have to get some therapy and work my way out of this small box I put myself in since I hit menopause. Like, oh God, life's over. Now what am I going to do? But
Are you into cycling? Have you been into cycling for a long time?
I ride my bike from the day I was born. I've ridden my bike. I have always lived on a bike. I can't live without my bike. It is my steed and my life. And I'm never happier than when I am dancing on my bike. So yeah. I love my bike.
And what kind of cyclist are you? Are you the full helmet, Lycra, the whole Tour de France look? Or are you?
If you're wearing a bunch of bright colors, I will pass you. Just shut up. No, I'm old school. I just try to wear black and an old t-shirt. You know, I'm not fancy. I don't race. My exercise is always personal to me. Like, I've always been a walker. At one point I was walking 8-10 miles a day, and people would say like, oh, Pam, can I get up and walk with you? And I'd say, no, nope, you can't. It's my time. And it is my time to just sort of, you know, it's my yoga. I get my endorphins going. I'm happy. I listen to music. I don't listen to podcasts. No offense, when I'm walking or riding, it's always music. It's always fun. And I really look forward to it every day. It's what I do. The last couple of years, I put on a couple of pounds. I'm not happy. I've not had my regular exercise because I have bit off more than I could chew, and I had to follow through with my commitments. And it has cost me in the health department, and I'm not doing that again. So I think it's so important to get exercise as an artist. Your brain has to move. It cannot move if you don't get the blood in there. You know, and it's like when I'm working with students, I make rules for them. Like, number one, you clean your studio every night. You do not wake up to dirty brushes. That's bad for art. You must always be reading. I don't care what you read, but you have to have input. And you have to exercise. If you're not exercising, you're not healthful. So you can do dark work and you can look like the old drunk in the studio. It's so passé, because it's really what makes great art is healthful thinking. Even if you do dark art, I really think to get the best dark art out of yourself, you have to let the intelligence in, and you have to make that happen. You have to grease the wheels. So exercise, reading, that sort of thing, I think is really important.
Very good.
I'm preaching now. Papa don't preach.
Well, I was going to ask you about teaching. You're a mentor at Laguna College of Art and Design. That's right, isn't it?
Yes. But I haven't done it for a couple of years. So I'm really busy, but I love it when I do it.
What do you think is the main thing you've learned from teaching?
That everyone has a different path and that your best advice may not work on that person. So I like how I like this setup. It works really well for me to work with one student at a time. Although I've taught, you know, full classes and loved it, I think for me it's best because I'm not as confident with a full class. You know, there are other people who can teach those things better than I can, you know, the technique and whatnot. So what I'm really good at is helping one student, you know, step up a bit and maybe get their work more sellable or find that one thing they're trying to make stand out and help them make that stand out. And so what I've learned is that, you know, I can come in there and say, oh, this is how you can do this and this and this. But what I really need to do is listen to, number one, what they want to do. And number two, how they seem comfortable going about it and then help them on that path rather than trying to jolt them into something else that's not comfortable for them. You know, there's some of that that goes on because they have to grow. But that's what I like about it is that, you know, I grow every time I work with a student because everything we talk about, I then apply to my work as well. And, you know, and I don't know, you know, I'm not I don't have a wealth of knowledge and I'm not overconfident in the teaching area. So what I try to do is keep up with the student. And that's been really good for me. And I think there's a whole lot of ego out there that people need to just calm it on down. No one's that great. And you know, I loathe ego on people and over ego and overconfidence, I think can really ruin art. So I also try to keep a student sort of in check and not be too full of themselves because that can destroy you too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned social media earlier on and, you know, as you say, you've been painting for a long time. So you've seen like the business side of art changing, particularly the last 10 years has changed a lot and it's kind of accelerated the change. What are your observations of how it's changed and where do you kind of see it going?
Well, at the risk of sounding horrible, I think there are a lot of big babies out there right now who do not understand how easy they have it. There are people on Instagram that have, you know, upwards of 100,000 followers, not because they're amazing, but because they've been on there a long time. And that's how the nature of the beast worked with the algorithms, how they were. And there's that whole issue going on. But I think that, you know, artists like myself who have been around as long as we have know what it's like to just sit and be unknown and work your ass off for 30 years. You know, it's hard. And then you hear people complaining or I'm not part of the contest or, you know, they apply for, there's so many contests out there now. Like when did art become a contest? Isn't each piece its own world? You know, how do you compare? And I have to admit, I switched this from social media to contests, but I think they're interrelated. I think there's just so much more FaceTime people can get. You know, they can just get so many more eyeballs on their work. So I think it's easier for people. And I've certainly more than happy to take advantage of it. And I've done the best I can with my technical limitations to utilize social media for myself. I kind of turned then and then I came back this way with that. But, it's hard to stay on point because I'm opinionated and I have a million things to say. But so to answer your question completely, I think that social media is good for a lot of things, but I think it can be a very false it can provide overconfidence for people that I don't like. You know, they get a few, you know, a few good things will happen and then they suddenly think that they're great because they've got gazillion followers and really it's not, the work's not that great and they need more time and they're young, but they don't see that. They see that they're a rock star and then it's like impossible to talk to them because they just think too much of themselves, you know, and they're not there yet. Yeah. They're not there. So that's the problem I see with it. But I think it's great for everyone across the board. It's brought a lot of light to art. It's changed the art world. And I think in a positive way for the most part, just by bringing it into every day, you know, it's there, it's available. Even on Instagram, you can get on there and you don't even have to say boo to anyone. You can just follow whomever you want. You don't have to be friends with anyone. You don't have to talk. And I like Instagram because, you know, you don't show your turkey on Instagram there's a lot of cat work on there, but you know, for the most part, the community that I'm in, it's about art. We don't want to see your awards. We don't want to see your cat. We don't want to see, your Thanksgiving turkey day. You know, we just want to see the art. And I really think that's what I look for on Instagram too. If I want to see a particular artist, I go, and I don't want to have to thumb through all of that personal stuff. That's, to me, that's Facebook. Go on Facebook and talk about, you know, your surgery or whatever. But on Instagram, in my community, it's mostly about the art, and that's what I like about it. I can just slip in, slip out. I can look, I can post, I can gain followers and get some, you know, word out, you know, and you're always trying to make that connection, but you can go too far too. And there are times, like right now, I'm on a hiatus from social media. I just can't look at it right now. And when I jump into my new work, I won't be on social media very much because I really want, I want to be hermetically sealed in my environment, and I want my art to be all about me. And what I'm doing, and the raw materials, and not, hello, and you know, there's just something about it that's sort of false to me, and some of it, I think, oh, those aren't real friends, but then you know, then you go meet them in real life, and you're so glad that you found them, you know, that kind of thing. So it's good and bad.
Yeah,
probably haven't answered that very well. It has its thing.
No, you have. Have you noticed that you're starting to sell directly to collectors through social media, or is it everything just still through your galleries?
Well, that's been a discussion that's come up a lot lately, and I've discussed that with people. And I think that for me, I'm still very traditional. Like there are artists who now carry their collectors with them to each gallery. And when they have a show, they send out an email blast to their collectors. And that's kind of new for me. I think I only have about 5 of my own real collectors because I come from a time when those collector lists were very protected from gallery to gallery. So most of the work that I've sold over the years, which is hundreds and hundreds of paintings, I don't even know who owns them. I don't know what dumpster they're in. You know, I have no idea. And so now what I'm starting to get is people will contact me directly and say, oh, I used to collect your art from like Claire Oliver back in New York in the 90s. I have these 3 pieces and they'll send me pictures. So that's kind of nice.
It's nice,
like, oh, I remember that. I don't have a record. This is before you even documented a painting with a picture. So I like that part of it. In fact, I now sort of feel comfortable calling some of my collectors and saying, hey, look, I've got this painting over here. You may be interested, but I'm also very aware of where I met that collector and with that gallery, and I try to be very respectful. But the times, they are a change in, and I'm not really sure what's cool and what isn't. So I tend to play it very safe, and I let my gallery earn their 50% by selling the work. That's not my job. So until it is my job, I try to let them do that. Because I'm very busy and I don't have time, and I'm not a salesperson. I'll give it away and you'll be sorry. I'll say, I couldn't charge you for that. You just take it. So I have to, you know, that's why I need a front man. I need someone to sell my work because I can't do it. Like most artists, we just give it away. You know, our self-worth is, well, some are better than others, but some of us are just nice. Like we just don't want to say, we don't want to have ego on us or anything. So, you know.
Okay. So when you're speaking of all the paintings that you've, the hundreds of paintings that you've made, which actually you probably will need to find out where they are when you have your retrospective, but that's another thing. When you think back on them all, is there one that stands out for you that was particularly emotional for you to make?
Oh, I'm sure there are. Well, I know very recently painting the girls, of which I spoke earlier, were probably the hardest paintings ever. For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
They were goodbye paintings. And never easy. And that's why we get to paint. Cause you know, it helps. I guess for me it helps. And sometimes it makes it worse. Cause a girlfriend said to me, like, why are you painting all of them all this time? You know, you broke up with them last January and you're still painting him and them. And I said, not because I'm trying to keep them around, but because I'm in this case processing. I am getting it all out and sending it off into painting. And now, and it actually worked because now I'm good. I'm free. I'm over it. It was a long relationship for me to get over for some reason. It was a very special one and I didn't want it to end. So, but then I realized in relationships, you always tell yourself that when you were caught off guard, you didn't want it to end. And then you start making shit up in your head, like it was way better than it was. And you know, so you got to get a hold of that tiger. You do. And so one of the ways for me was to actually paint them instead of put it all away. I just brought it all out. And those were particularly hard, probably a couple of them really hard because I love those girls so much. But to answer your question, the emotional ones are the ones where I really love someone and I can't be with them in some way.
Yeah. Right. Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then, but they're still models at the same time. They're not portraits of those girls. Their names are nowhere near it. You know, I don't call them by that. It's just an emotion, I think, that I'm tagging in the painting. It's the emotion of being in love with someone that age. They cease to be them when I'm painting them, and they don't even quite look like them. I may change certain features. So they are the impetus for an emotional painting, and that can be very difficult for me because I'm looking at them. But the painting itself is about me. It's not about them.
Yeah. Okay.
Just to clarify.
Okay. So speaking of, you know, younger people and thinking about your life, if there's like, if thinking about the next generation and passing things forward, if there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would you think it would be?
Do not adhere too closely to the rules. You know, don't let people tell you that this is how painting has to be. There's a whole lot of talk about there, how you have to paint from life or you're not a real artist. And I say painting from life is extremely limiting as far as your imagination. So it's one tool, it's one way to learn to paint the figure well, but that should not be your goal, is to paint from life. That's something in your arsenal, for instance. And so I'd say to make sure you're like you turn a painting upside down to see something different in it, or to divorce yourself or free yourself, I think the same with rules. You have to turn them on their head. You have to, you can't let people tell you what you're supposed to paint and what it's supposed to look like or whom to vote for. Just had to throw that in. You know, you have to learn to think for yourself, and you have to be, this is part of the reason to keep your brain sharp, is that you have to always be able to think for yourself. You have to think, is this a rule that I need to keep, or is this something I can run right over? And the answer should always be, if I want, I can run right over this rule. And that's how new things are discovered.
Right. Very good.
I would say save your money. Do not put all of your energy, and I've said this before, do not put all of your energy into your outfit and how you look and looking cool and all that kind of thing. Put your energy and your money into your art.
Very good. Okay. Well, I'm afraid I've spent all my money on my outfit already, but the next bit of money, I'll save it. All right.
I'm sorry. I can't see that. Oh. I imagine you looking awesome after that. Funny
job. Okay. Well, your website is just your name, isn't it? PamelaWilson.com?
It's PamelaWilsonFineArt.com.
FineArt.com. Okay, I'll put a link in the show notes. I think all your social media links off it. If it doesn't, if there's a bit missing, like your Instagram or something like that, I'll put a link off that as well.
Okay, I have to say something about that very quickly. Yes. Because of the schedule, the horrendous schedule I've been under, I have not been able to post a new painting since January of 2015. And I have to redo my website because I upgraded my computer, and I literally have not had a moment or $1 million to pay someone to do it for me. In fact, I offered it and couldn't find anyone to do it. And so I'm just now in the next month or so going to redo my website. But what you'll find current events on there, but I'm so glad I got to say this, but I have to get new work on there, and I do everything myself. So I have to redo my website in the next couple of weeks. Mm. So
your Facebook is pretty current, and I think your Instagram is pretty current as well.
Yes,
though
those are so both if, current. Yes,
yeah so if you can't see it on one, but your website's good for seeing, you know, quite a lot of your work, which is good.
Sure. Up until 2015, so
yeah
but you know, I hate that that's been undone, because I'm an organized person. I operate well when I'm organized, and I prefer to be organized on top of things. But the last 2 years have just been a rolling train, and I really have, you know, I've got 2 years of taxes to do too. So I actually didn't even finish the work I was trying to finish, but I just ran out of gas. My body just said, no, I have to stop. Yeah. I have to see. I'll get back to those in a couple of weeks, but I really, and so I told the gallery waiting for those paintings, I said, for the first time in my life, I'm just out of steam. I have to stop. I have to get organized. So I'm doing that, and then I'll be right back to work. So, but I'm still trying to keep that time so that I can experiment. So,
You know, you can always outsource that kind of stuff. You can outsource your website. You can outsource your taxes and all that kind of stuff.
I try.
There's lots of websites like Elance and whatever. And then you just, you know, say what you want done. People bid on it. And, you know, it's got a rating system and all that kind of thing.
I've got to learn that. And that's the other problem, is that I don't even have a chance to learn that kind of stuff. Because I'm literally, I have not been out of the studio for over two years. With two or three solo shows, at least 10 group shows, and all of them back to back. I mean, I just haven't had a minute. So I'm so excited to learn that. And I'm going to ask you about that. Say that one more time. I'll ask you off here.
Elance is the one that comes to mind, elance.com. But there's quite a few that, that do the two similar kind of things.
I'll start there. Thank you, John.
You're welcome. Okay, well, it's been really nice chatting with you. Now, before I get into this bit, I wanted to read out, because I think this says a lot about you. Somebody, when I, because I normally say I'm going to be chatting with this artist, and if you have any questions you want to, you need to ask them, like the ones I asked. But I got this message, and the person said they want to be kept anonymous, and they said, I'd also like you to thank Pam for the Pammy Scholarship. She sent me some sable brushes when I couldn't afford any. She's a pretty caring person and an amazing artist. And don't mention my name. So I think that says a lot about you.
Well, thank you. And
yeah, I really like your art as well. But like to me, the art is one thing and then the person is another thing and the person's more important. So I think that just that if somebody took the trouble to do that for that one person, there's probably hundreds that you've done some similar things to. So that's lovely and brilliant and well done. And this speaks very highly for you as a human being. And that's very inspirational. Now onto the art stuff.
I think kindness makes the world go round, and that's people have given to me and I try to give back to you. Yeah. It's very nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Kindness is great. Highly underrated and great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, technically, like, your work is very good. Gee, you know, I can see why there's all this thing about photographs, because they're very, you know, it's not photorealistic, you know, it's a painting, but geez, they're very, very good. So that's inspiring. It's always inspiring to see somebody who's got really high levels of technical skill and craft. You know, that's just brilliant. And then you've got like what's going on in your paintings as well, which is like right back, you know, from all the older stuff that I've seen, right back from the word go, there's such a personal signature to your work. I don't think it can be confused with anybody else's, not even steampunk stuff. I don't think that's, I think that's more coincidental than anything else. But each one, there's very few pictures. And in fact, I don't think I saw any where you kind of go, oh, yeah, that's just, that's, yeah, whatever. You know, like normally when you're flicking through people's work, you know, there's always one or two. It's like the when music used to be in albums, there's always like three or four dud ones and there's some great songs kind of thing. You know, when you're looking through people's bodies of work, there's always the few duds. But I didn't see anything in yours that didn't kind of make me immediately get pulled into the narrative. You can't help, I don't think, anyway, look at your stuff and kind of go, what the hell is going on there? Why is that person got that thing holding there? What's that about? And immediately you're into the story of what's all that, you know, and the way that you put all the different elements together, you can't fix it in a time. You can't fix it in a place. It's just very good, I think. It's just so compelling, you know, and I mean, I have a very kind of simple criteria for what's good. And if it just stops me and keeps me looking and kind of re-looking and just when I'm about to move on, I want to go back and look at another little bit of it. So, yeah, it's very good. Very, very good.
That's very high praise, John. Thank you very much. That's all I ever wanted to do. So I got me crying. Thank you. That means a lot to me.
Well, I mean it.
We all just want to tell stories. You know, I grew up with these amazing aunties who grew up in the South, and they're all gone now, but one's left and got to go visit her. But, you know, they had me laughing my whole life with their storytelling, and I've never been able to tell stories. So I paint them. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're doing a great job. It's brilliant. Okay, I'm sure we'll be in touch again, but for now we'll say goodbye.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been really fun to talk about myself. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
You're lovely.
Okay. All right. Well, till the next time then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Remember to go to the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/John Dalton Gently Does It and join the conversation.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti. Yeah, we are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on.